Now.
This dog's. This is a breed now, but it turns out to be having exactly the same mutation as in the miniature schnauzers, where the dogs have real severe skeletal deformities, and they're stunted, they're called dwarfs, and they have very, unfortunately, severely abnormally shaped and size back spine vertebral bodies compared to normal. And what we can do is actually we can really see skeletal deformities. They also have eye changes on the cornea, and they have also neurological signs. For us as clinician, or for me as a laboratory person, I should probably say, we can see these white cells having granulations that are abnormal, as well as we have urine tests that allows us quickly to see what it is. Now, we took this further and actually were able to, able to get a DNA test. So for that one, because we had the gene involved, which is L-sulfatase B, we were able to go and sequence that quickly because we had a candidate gene, and we know it. And we have about five dogs that are affected over the past 5 years or so, and it is definitely not in the main line of breed, but you should think of it because, like in some other breeds, like the miniature pinschers, it is rampant in that breed. Wow. And in this breed, it's not a common thing at all. So I do consider it rare in the miniature schnauzer. Don't worry too much, but if you see it, you should probably be aware because you could easily test and utilize some of the kinds of testing for the breeding for the future, because you can still use some of the carriers as we have a DNA test. Now, the other one is the miniature schnauzer, Myotonia congenita, and I think in this one I'm going to have to quickly drop out to show you that movie. I showed that before, but I just wanted to make sure that you understand that this is actually a disease that was common in the breed and involved a particular dog. And so these miniature schnauzers look fine and they get up. And then when they want to go and run, they realize they have a problem because their muscle starts to cramp. And so they're getting cramping, and so they're hesitant to jump here out of the cage, because if they are going to jump, their muscle is going to get stiff, like a fainting goat type of issue. And that is unfortunate, you know, that they have this kind of issue, which is a muscle disease. Now, that was really a long time ago when we studied on that one. That's why I'm saying I'm involved with the miniature schnauzers for quite some time. And you can see afterwards they can limp away and they can do okay. But it does cramp on them, and then they're going to get better. If you look at the dogs, they actually have sort of like Schwarzenegger's muscles, you know, hypertrophy, and that's the typical situation. And in this disease, due to the fact that we were able to get the mutation established, that breed, that disease is pretty much eliminated, with rare exceptions where someone has probably ignored the breeding or the knowledge of this disease, and that caused the mutation to be passed on. So right now, I want to tell the ones that have tested, along with the screening for MAC, they actually had their dogs cleared. So that's a really good thing to know, but it wasn't past an issue. The way you can find them easily is that their muscles are hypertrophied. You see this shoulder here. And also their mouth is actually peak-like. It's narrow. And if you touch the tongue, it actually gets an indentation. And so it has dramatic features that we can also show by electromyography. And it does have this very simple mutation in the gene that is expected to be involved in myotonia congenita, which is a chloride channel 1. So that actually turned out to be a very successful story, because we were allowed to name the dog that was the common ancestor, who was a carrier determined to be, I'm allowed to say it, shooting sparks, and it was known to be that way. And you can see in an analysis of many of the carriers, we always were able to get back to this carrier, which was the common ancestor. So that narrowed the field, but over 3,000 dogs got tested worldwide. It might actually be now even more, because everyone tests for that. It's on the panel tests, it's everywhere. But as far as we know, originally it was 18% carriers, and it's now to less than 0.1%.
Wow.
It is really eliminated to the greatest extent. Also, there are occasionally people who still see it. And what we do find is frequently it comes from other countries rather than the United States or so. So if you are wondering about diseases, you could go on the WSAVA, Hereditary Disease Committee website. It's open to everyone. Or you can go on our site, which is PenGen, that you can see all the tests available for miniature schnauzers at the current time. Or if you have other breeds, they're on there as well. So it's a simple way to go and look for that, and you can get all the information about DNA tests that are available. So, now I'm going to get to the real story, and that is Mac. And I want to just start off and acknowledge everyone who really contributed. And I think that's probably the whole group here in the audience. So, you know, I want to thank everyone in here who contributed and also showed interest and continue to show interest in eliminating this type of problem and getting to the answers. I think it wouldn't have been possible without some major people in the group here. And that is worthwhile mentioning. Carol has been obviously instrumental from a long time ago, and she was recognizing this problem for many, many years and has handled it to the best level possible. And then Patty became the chair of the health committee, and really she took this on very seriously as a leader in organizing things to get things done, and Kurt also helped a lot with various things. So I just want to say, having a health club like yours is tremendously important and valuable to assure that the breed is going to move in the right direction. Because it's not possible for us as scientists alone to get this done. We do need the cooperation, we need the samples, we need your observation. And we still work on this disease. We don't have everything. I also want to acknowledge Erlen Martin, who really brought the project with Kurt to me many years ago and worked on that and has helped with some of the pedigree analysis. I mentioned the breeders before, but also there are many veterinary clinicians. And one of them is actually Lisa Sarvis here, who is actually a past fellow of mine. She's Canadian originally, but lives now down south more, but was in the Philadelphia area and has been a schnauzer breeder ever. And certainly people like her are very important for your club to understand the diseases and gathering. I also want to mention Natalia Ignatenko. She lives and works in Kiev, and I met her a couple of, maybe 3 years ago or so, when I gave a seminar in Kiev in order to help that country to get out of its trouble. And so I said, okay, I'll come and give a day seminar, and it was a wonderful experience. They really are deprived of much of what we have here. And she was then listening to what I was doing, and I told her about this. And sure enough, she found a dog. And she has a dog in her clinic in Kiev and is managing it at the moment and trying to see what's going on. And so this happens sometimes, you know, but we know it's international. Much of what we did is originally under the Institutes of Health grant that we really have a very fortunate situation that the National Institutes of Health recognizes that dogs and cats are good models of human disease. And I've been using that for decades, actually, since I came to Penn, more or less, that we established the grant, and that is substantial money. You know, we are talking big money, because it is for establishing models of human disease. These are naturally occurring, and that allowed us to actually work on this disease for many years, you know.
just getting samples analyzed, logged, and processed, etc., and then do the initial studies for the candidate genes that fit. We didn't get the answer because they were normal, but that was really important and still is in many ways because it is a very much substantial part of my salary and other aspects of mine. But specifically, we could not have done it without the Gray Lady Foundation as well as the AKC Kenan Health Foundation, which were driven by you and Carol's huge contributions and others. Everyone else counts, every dollar counts. That is really fantastic to get to this level. Now, besides obviously the funding, I think we do need people. And I was very fortunate to work with some really great people. And one of them is Keichiro Mizukami, who came to me 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago, and he worked on a project on cystinuria, which Lisa actually did work on too in Newfoundland. But he then worked on cats originally and has then moved on to this and has been instrumental, and actually he was the one that discovered the specific mutation. So he gets it right. I also had a student, Angela Dorsey Oresta, who was actually a microbiologist who did some of the original work as well. And two other people I just want to mention, Anna Heringis as well as Karthik Raj. These are the people in my lab. Anna wanted to be here, but her family took her to Toronto because it's Fulbright. And so she couldn't say no to that. It was a toss-up, but she's really happily involved in this whole thing. And Karthik, I don't know if you met Lisa or him, he is a very shy person, does not want to do anything like that, but he's very instrumental in my life. And then we have collaborators, Gary Johnson at Missouri. I mentioned Eva Furrow from Minnesota, and Tasso Lee, who is a colleague in Switzerland, because I'm actually partially on sabbatical and came back to talk with you today that we are working on this thing. And this is our small animal hospital with 4 floors. And if you are emailing me, and you can find my name as phone numbers, etc. as well, but email is the best way. That's where my office is still, and all my labs are up here. But my clinics on Mondays and Tuesdays are downstairs on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd floor. So, in tuberculosis or Mycobacterium avium complex, or short now, MAC, has been seen in many different species, but in general it's believed that dogs are resistant, just like people. And it has been rarely seen overall because we are so good equipped to defend that. And so there are rare reports of canine disease, and as was mentioned, as of 1990, there are a couple of reports either in the miniature schnauzer or the bassets. Other than that, there's pretty much no reporting of avian tuberculosis, which I think is quite remarkable. And so we are aware of probably, I should say, 25 years of this, and from our study might actually be even a little earlier that we can track the first case, but it's not yet 100% sure. But the first reports came actually from bassets and then from the others. It's always the young and middle-aged dogs that are being affected with these bacteria. And this may not be visually that well, but you can actually have a special stain called acid fasting that gives you that kind of pinkish color, and you see for avian tuberculosis lots of these bacteria in cells, lots, versus for some other types it's a few. And that for if one does a biopsy or a cytology, some tissue with cells, and or you should find the organism. It should be possible. Now, most people will not miss that, but if it's not a trained person, it could be a problem. So what do we see? These dogs have not necessarily very specific signs. Many of the things can be confused with lots of different things, just not feeling well and progressively getting ill or not having a good appetite and thereby losing weight. They may show weakness. They have nasal discharge. They may have some coughing, conjunctivitis, diarrhea, anything that sort of like gives you an exudate, something external. But the more important part, I think, is the lymphadenopathy. So every one of us has multiple lymph nodes in our bodies, and some of them are peripheral. So you can see them outside, actually. You can touch them from the outside, versus others are somewhere in the chest or abdomen or somewhere else. But if you are feeling, for instance, in this area, there might be sort of like little balls here, or even in the front of the shoulder, you might feel those, or in the inguinal area, and then particularly also here behind the knee. You know, it does show quite nicely these lymph nodes. And frequently, these are actually enlarged. And that makes a problem in regard to the diagnosis, because if people, clinicians, see that, frequently they think it's actually lymphoma. It's a cancer. It does look like that. If you would be in the Mediterranean, they would think of leishmaniasis. For us, it probably is also some type of a cancer, like a histiocytic carcinoma, sarcoma, or it could be a fungal disease if you live in a certain part of the world where, you know, some of the fungal diseases are happening just in parts of the United States as well. So this is actually one of the dogs that does have the disease at this moment, and in fact was already recognized to have 4 months of this infection, and I was allowed to show this picture, not necessarily identified dog, but at least show you that these dogs look kind of like failing to thrive. They're sick, they're febrile, and I didn't mention fever here, which is a cardinal sign as well, that they're very frequently febrile as well. And the only way to diagnose is really get a sample before we have the DNA test. And then based on that tissue sample, one could say if something was really present or not. So the tissue samples can look in some ways. This is obviously from an autopsy, where you have nodules, which is kind of classic for a granulomatous disease, that you can have these sorts of things on the spleen. This is the spleen, this will be the liver. And if you're getting them to the tissue, it's far difficult to see because the lights up here are a little bright, but I think it is having a little bit of a pink shadow, and that pinkness is the part that is actually abnormal for this for this disease. I think here these little things show a little better. These are classic bacteria that you can see. So going back, and this is now looking at the dogs that were affected, it became clear that there was a common ancestry for many of these dogs. You know, as much as one could see, there was something related. And we were trying then to get samples from many of these dogs as these came around, which took always a little bit extra time. Not everyone was quite easy to get the sample. You know, I have probably 10,000 emails for this disease just in order to get this going, and another 1,000 phone calls or so to make people to actually finally send the sample. And then when it's sent, you know, depending on from where it is, it may still take extra work to get it actually to us. So, for instance, the Kiev sample ended in Spain first, then went to Germany, and then ultimately came to the United States, but it took an enormous amount of time to just get it here. But what I want to do is, with this pedigree, without going into details, one of the big questions that came up was, is this now really genetic or not? And I think when you have common ancestry and everybody is related, that makes a lot of sense. The second point was, people were thinking this was a complex trait. Complex trait means it's complicated. It's not likely going to get solved, because at the moment, there is not a single trait that has actually been resolved as a complex trait. So my colleagues were questioning why I would think it is simple inherited, but we did the analysis and it was fitting for simple genetic, and it turned out to be autosomal recessive. That means males and females pretty much equally affected, and usually you have parents that are clinically not affected, but then the offspring are. So this fit quite nicely. So we had, obviously, lots of samples collected from dogs that are affected as well as lymph-related dogs. I did leave out right now what we did. We did actually the candidate gene approach, because 10 years ago, we could not do the genomic approach. It was not yet possible to really get that done. at that time we had some candidates. One was called, you know, actually resistance against avian tuberculosis, which was known as the N-ramp protein 1. Made a lot of sense that this could be it, and we sequenced and found nothing. We sequenced another gene that we felt was very important, found nothing. And so we had to go and look at the whole genome and see if we can find something. And that's the whole genome-wide association study. In addition, what that is, it doesn't only give you the region in the genome where something happens, but you needed to know what's in that region. And so we had to go and actually get that region sequence, and that's the whole genome sequence. This was only affordable in the last few years. Before, it was so outrageously expensive and time-consuming, we could not do that. But over the past 5 years, it is actually possible to get that done. And so we had several dogs affected with avian tuberculosis that we could sequence. We can compare that to sequence from normal miniature schnauzers to other dogs of other breeds, and then also for the whole genome sequence that was published to see what the thing is. So we had obviously then a specific area where the gene was involved, and then identified the very precise mutation. And then finally, what we also need to know is what is the immune dysfunction. Well, we know it gets avian tuberculosis, but we don't know how it actually happens exactly, and is it only avian tuberculosis or is it other things as well? We have some suspicion, but we don't have the answer actually for that one, so this is still our work in progress. So let me show you how we did this. So if you're looking at the dog here, a miniature schnauzer or a beagle, the DNA is always in the nucleus of a cell. And so any cell that has a nucleus, and the red cell would not have a nucleus, but all the other ones have a nucleus, they have the DNA. They actually have all the DNA for all the genes involved. And that is quite important. And they are organized in chromosomes. And the dog is quite unique in that, the dog has actually 78 chromosomes, which is way more than people when you think of 23andMe and things like that, so you can gather how many chromosomes. So there are lots more chromosomes that are present, and overall the gene number is actually fairly similar between mammals. It's about 20,000-25,000 genes that are involved, and it is based on about 3 billion bases. There are a few species that might be different, but in regard to that, that's a kind of the classic. So you can see, it's a fishing expedition to see which one base might be different to cause the disease, which may be all what it takes to cause this illness. So you need informatics, you need big programs, you need lots of work that Cature then put in to get to that level. So these genome-wide association studies are based on SNPs, and I'll explain that in a moment. But more or less is we have little markers on the different chromosomes here in green depicted. There are actually over 170 markers that are on these chromosomes. Thousands, sorry, not 170, 170,000 markers. And they are slightly different between animals, but there are only 4 bases, so many of them are the same. And there's a very simple way with a microchip that allows us to get this analyzed for each animal very quickly and nicely. And so this is the analysis then in order to get DNA. So we need to get the polymerase chain reaction, which just means that we have a way to amplify that small amount of DNA that we get from the cheek swab, or we get it from an EDTA sample, and we can get that amplified through a machine nowadays, and then get the specific gene area involved. So, looking then at only a few affected dogs, but many normal dogs of the same breed, with the GWAS, this genome-wide association study, each point here depicts actually then a result, one SNP. And if you're looking at this whole block here, what does it look like?
Pretty homogeneous.
Well, I think it looks a little bit like the Manhattan, New York area. And indeed, this is known as the Manhattan plot. There are little high rises, and the highest one is shown here. And this is now a GWAS example. I'm not giving you actually the exact analysis that we have, because we haven't published it, and so I don't want to do that. But it's the same principle. It's the same thing, that we had one area where there is a peak, where there's a difference, because that's background noise. You know, these are the older high-rises, and these are the newest one, which are the tallest one. And that one is the hit where we're going to go after. So we had this area that we were interested in, and that happens to be not, it is not on chromosome 15, but it shows it here on chromosome 15, just to show you the example how that actually goes. Now, the chromosome is still big, and there are lots of genes on it and lots of bases, so you're going to have to look at this much more fine. But at the bottom, at the very end, we compare normal to the affected ones, and we come up with something called a single nucleotide polymorphism. And that means if you're looking here, this is the sequence that we got in this area that is of high interest. We can see here is a dog that has everything the same as dog 1, 2, 3, except in this bracketed area. The top one has a tall peak that is a G. The bottom one has a tall peak that is a T, which is red here. And then if you look very carefully here in dog 2, you actually going to appreciate there is a smaller peak, right? Do we agree?
Yep.
And there's a double peak if you look closely.
Yeah.
And that will be a carrier. So you have the normal here, the carrier here, and the affected here. So this is kind of the simple separation that we can make now in doing sequencing. We are not doing it normally now with sequencing, but that is a way to kind of separate between the animals. So we can use EDTA blood. We can use cheek swab. EDTA blood can actually be drawn from a one-day-old puppy without any problem. It's not difficult. It does, you know, 1 ml is not a problem for them. The cheek swabs are really good. We could potentially do it in semen. We could potentially do it in some tissue samples that are stored, but that's not our preferred way. We are not in the forensic business. We are really in the, you know, the medical genetic testing. And for that, you really want to get something where you have robust sample quality. Cheek swabs are not good in nursing puppies because the puppies might have then milk from the mother, which may be from a carrier or a normal, which is not affected, but that can be influenced. Even if you're doing it from an adult, it's good to fast the animal, assure that nothing is in the mouth, and then get a good brush off the cheek, because we want to get the cheek cells. We don't want to have the saliva. I always had to tell that about the new fish that Lisa was working on. They have goober all over. but that's not the stuff that I need. We need DNA, and that's the cheek stuff.
Yes, they do.
So the way we are analyzing at the moment is actually we do have this real-time PCR methodology, which allows for a faster analysis, and it's really well controlled and precise, that you can actually see. This is a block that we get at the end, and each dot represents a sample from you that one can look at. Also, this is from a pre-screening when we did the original dogs with all the affected. So you see here, up here is a cloud of several dogs that are affected. Down here is a group of animals that are all normal. And then you have in the middle, in between, you have the carriers. And they come actually even color labeled. So you're really going to have a relatively absolute way of determining affected, carrier, normal. There's pretty much no question about it, right? And so we have tested over 300 miniature schnauzers since June, right? This does not include all the samples from before, where we have obviously a lot more carriers and a lot of affected. But at the moment, we come up with about an 8% carrier rate. Now, just to give that a perspective, in humans, 1% is called high frequency. We are at 8%, you know. Now it is less than the Myotoni originally, but that was a very focused group that we obtained. So I think this is a very, very significant group. Now it is encouraging to see of these dogs that we screened, two-thirds at least have been submitted to the Canine Health Committee, the American Miniature Schnauzer Club Committee, Health Committee, and indeed the frequency is about the same. You know, you can see that as well. And we have also an affected in that group to report, and that's good. And if one goes and looks at ancestry as of today, with a couple of exceptions that we are pursuing, it does look like they are related to your commonly known ancestors. It is, however, not sure that these are the original dogs that had it. We have not tested them. So it could actually be further back, and that means it would spread further. And we do have people who have told us that they don't seem to see the pedigree-related information that would refer to these two newsprint and shock dogs. And so I think we are going to see far more carriers in that group and few others, but there is a possibility. And that is why one needs to go and still look at the other ones as well. This is a very small survey at this point, I have to say, because I was expecting a lot more. Not that I want to test more dogs, but I think for the breed, it will be very important. Just to think about what we did with the myotonia. That disease, who has seen it? Maybe one or two people in this audience, but most of the people, this was gone in 2000 or so. It is really amazing. And we have over 3,000 dogs tested. We had a similar disease, it's a neurological disease, introduced last year, December or so, I think it was, or maybe, yeah, December, in Papillons. And they are here at the Montgomery, right? And they had embellished, I mean, has, you know, just gone out and tested these dogs and have doubled the number of yours. I don't think it's a bigger breed, right? Papillons versus you, by far. Yeah, I know, it's far smaller. But I think, you know, you can see some people were really more into the testing and got that really well established. So I think, you know, if you're looking at these sorts of things, you might actually really want to get a better basis to understand what's going on. Now, this is the other one. So I just want to say about accuracy of the test, because that's always questions, you know. Now, peer review papers are important. That is true. We released the test because we felt the disease was such a severe disease that we did not want to withhold information. We also got the cooperation from the club, and we informed, we tested everything with colleagues and so on, that everything that we did is correct. There's no question that this test is correct, and the screening has proven that as well. So we are working on it. We need to know about the immune dysfunction, because there are certain requirements in regard to getting publications done, and that will be good to have. So I do agree it's a good thing to have peer review, but even peer review doesn't tell you if it's right or not, because there are multiple papers that have been published that had to be withdrawn from, you know, falsified information to, unfortunately, a wrong association. So that can happen too. So I feel very, very confident, and so does Pedro, that this is the right test, and so far everything has been perfect. I actually believe there is no better test than DNA testing for genetic diseases currently available in human or veterinary medicine. This is a most accurate test. It's a simple type of process to do that. And the main issue in regard to accuracy is probably in the dog identification and human error. So it can happen, but that is what happens with any other tests as well. You know, it is unfortunately something that one tries to limit, and everyone tries very hard, but we are still at the end human and could be making a small mistake. You know, that happens on occasions. So for the MAC test, we are very much assured that this is precise to detect carriers and effective. And it, just the example that caused somewhat of an uneasiness in the whole breed, that one was identifying, we had known that Lola was an affected dog, and then tested the sire, or the supposed sire, and it turned out that this dog was normal. Actually, it was not that much of a total surprise, because I think the line behind there wasn't that clear that there was going to be a carrier in that background. And so it was just very confusing, but we were fortunate to hear that there was actually at the same time another dog in the that kennel. And sure enough, that turns out that instead of Blue, Mikey was the father. Now, that took a lot of investigation and concerns, and I think also concerns for the health club and so on. But I think, again, from a scientific standpoint, we pursued that carefully and identified the parent based on parentage testing. And that was done by an outside lab, because that is AKC type of study and was done without anything that we could change or anything like that, if you had even thought of that. But it is now nice to know this is actually the pedigree and not that. And that's why, you know, I know you have done good breedings, but little accidents even with breeding can happen, that you might have confused the stud, or you might have confused the puppy and so on, that at the moment it probably will be best to test every dog that is being bred, in order to not have suddenly other puppies come up missing. And it is quick, because, you know, initially you're not going to see something, but when you're doubling up then with two carriers, then you're going to have effectives. And I'm very close to the end, but I just want to point out, for autosomal recessive inheritance, just like myotonia as well as MAC is, or mucopolysaccharidosis for that matter, when you breed a carrier with great qualities, she can be safely used, or he can be safely used, for future, to contribute to the future production of dogs, as long as it's going to be bred to a normal dog. So if you're looking at that, the outcome of a breeding between a carrier and a male, it doesn't really matter which one is the carrier, the sire or the dam, you're going to get half of them approximately to be carriers. They're 1-2s, and half of them to be clear. So you actually, in the first generation, already have about 50-50 chance to have normals. You can have all five normals, or, you know, all five could be carriers. I mean, it's flipping a coin, right? It doesn't matter, male, female, also. But overall, you have options, and even if you would have carrier, you could probably go back to this type of breeding and breed the carrier to another normal, and you can still continue if she or he is the best dog that you can use for your agility or your show or whatever purpose it is, or if it's just your preferred breeding. Now, the problem is really when you're breeding carrier to carrier, and that should be avoided. Because if you are breeding carrier to carrier, you're going to end up potentially with affected dogs. And it turns out to be 25% affected plus 50% carriers, leaving you with really only a quarter to be completely normal. And so because of these affecteds here, this breeding should not be done, but this one should be done in order to preserve actually the gene pool. Miniature schnauzers, I think, are not endangered like some other species potentially are, or breeds, but this one is a really good breed, and the heterogeneity is making the breed better rather than making it a narrow pool. So breeding recommendations against MAC, I think breed only DNA-tested miniature schnauzers. Certainly in the future, dogs can then be cleared by tested parents. But that takes at least one more generation to be sure that your line that you're breeding is really clear. And I think that is a good recommendation, because some things could happen. The DNA testing does not determine if you can breed or not, but with who, you know? Mm-hmm. Sort of like a little match.com. So, you know, you're going to have to select the right partner, and you're going to be fine, or otherwise you're going to have problems, right? and obviously avoid breeding carriers to carriers. Or do not, sorry, this actually says do not avoid breeding carriers in order to preserve the gene pool and the genetic diversity of the breed. It's, I think, very important to do that. Just remember, when you breed carriers, you're going to have to test the offspring that you want to use for breeding. If they're not used for breeding and are concentrated in spay, then you wouldn't actually need to do that for your own information. And then, you know, a general sentence that I think when we are talking about several diseases, you're not going to breed against one disease only. That will bring you other problems. So you need to look at the whole dog, at the whole breeding program, at the whole breed, and then make the right decisions based on that. So I hope I was able to give you, in a nutshell, a little bit what the progress is. I think it's an exciting time. I think we have the thing under control, and we can look forward to better times in regard to not having to worry about this disease in the future. So thank you again for all the contributions that you made in sample submissions, to your interest, to financial support, to all the hard work from the leadership down to every one of you. Thank you so much.
That you would like to pose, please feel free to do so.
Sorry.
No questions?
No.
Is that good?
I got a Norwegian question.
Okay.
I'm from Norway. I have one question only, because we're having a discussion in Norway about the validity of the testing. In Norway, we are actually asking vets to do the swab samples, because so we can identify the dogs. We don't see that in the U.S. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. So Norway, part of Scandinavia, is a very good example where hereditary diseases have been taken extremely serious from the whole, breed club organizations. And they are actually requiring by law, as well as by recommendations from the club, to go very strictly on these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so I understand you will require blood samples in Norway and some other countries in order to also identify the dog by being present with a veterinarian.
Yeah, but we can also do swabs with the veterinarian.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's fine. I just wanted to say, you can go potentially and get it through the veterinarian and get the swabs and then submitting by having the dog identified with the microchip. Now, it is a good way, I think. It is a little bit more expensive if one does it that way, because that gets a charge. And in this country, the regulations in regard to who is allowed to breed in regard to genetic predispositions of disease has not been that strictly done. There is no regulation in regard to are you allowed to breed a carrier or not, whereas in your country, and I was just visiting a couple of weeks ago in Oslo and spoke there, it's clear that you could actually be in violation of laws if you breed a carrier to a dog, you know, to another dog,
I know.
Which is extreme. So I'm actually hoping the U.S. is not going to get into the situation that you're in, where the laws are stronger than what actually the science would require. Because from a scientific standpoint, breeding carriers is a good thing.
I agree on that one, but
I think we're all in agreement.
Identifying the
dogs. Identification of dogs
yeah.
is on an honorary base in this country mostly.
Yeah.
I hope all the breeders are conscientious and try and really identify each of their animals correctly. There are, however, possibly some black sheep around, as well as possibly some human errors that can happen. And I just showed you one example. So things like that happen, and the AKC, the American Kennel Club, has not engaged much further than a little bit of the parentage testing The microchipping is coming and is needed, but it doesn't yet connect the two things. Now, in the future, my prediction is that you're going to have panel tests, and the panel tests for genetic diseases will also include the parentage profile. At the current time, that is done by microsatellite type things, but in the future, there is a possibility with all the new technology that this can be built into the SNP analysis as we are doing it for genetic diseases. But at the moment, the DNA testing by panel is SNP-based, which means single nucleotide base exchanges, and that is not what the AKC as well as other clubs are requiring for parentage testing. So this will merge probably this coming year because everyone is having improvements in the technology that allows for more inexpensive general screening that you can screen for all the diseases, and that makes it then more, even better possible to identify each of the dogs. The only other problem is patenting. You know, we decided never to patent any of my tests. You know, that's what I decided because I was believing this was a natural occurrence. I didn't generate that, and secondly, I did get funding from the National Institutes or from a canine health club or so that I didn't necessarily want to put on a $10,000 legal patent, plus then have everyone pay for all the services through license agreements and so on. But that could still be a little bit a tricky situation for some of the DNA tests. But it's a good question. And thanks for coming from Norway here. It's a beautiful country.
It is.
Other questions? So can I ask who has tested? Okay. Who plans to test? Okay. So it's nearly everyone. So it's, that's really great. Right, from that standpoint. Has anyone, I can't ask that question. It brings up actually a good point. You know, I want to be confidential to everyone, and I'm not going to release names that haven't been released and publicized to be that way. So even if someone has said some dog has it or so, unless I'm allowed to say that, I'm not going to do it. So we are not going to disclose anything, so you can actually discuss anything with us, and we are not telling anyone. I'm not telling Patty or others in the club or so. We are going to keep that confidential, but we are very much for an open registry. You know, we are very much for that you would post the results with the health club first, and then you can also go for the chick. You know, which is another way to get this established. And chick is not the same as you have, but in Europe, that's not the same. Also, I think you have some people that go on chick as well. And, there are other ways to get this done. Yes?
If a dog is affected, what is the lifespan on a dog like that? Could be okay. Conditions.
So the lifespan for dogs that are affected are actually difficult to say right now because we get them usually late, you know. It's predicted probably with this screening that we will pick up a couple of dogs or more, you know, affected dogs, because unfortunately they have had the breeding done some time ago, but the age is sort of like 1 to maybe 4 years of age, so they may just show up in the near future about it. So for us to say how long they are ill, it's difficult because we usually get to hear about them only if they're seriously ill. But they may actually have for months before some lingering signs that were sort of like just not well or so. I also have to say I haven't seen a dog that was really an agility dog that might have had more activity that really needed to perform, you know, that one could see some of that. So, but in a typical situation, it's weeks to months. Treatment has not been successful in any way. And that is, in humans, they can treat avian tuberculosis. They usually use at least 3 drugs, but more often, you know. And it is, you know, under intensive treatment, as well as in many of these situations, it's not such a severe defect like an avian tuberculosis genetic predisposition of the miniature schnauzer. No. So from that side, we feel it fails. I didn't want to bring up, but I might need to mention it since we have a little time here. You know, it is a zoonotic disease. It is a disease that can affect people. And it is, again, it's not us probably in the audience per se, but it is the very young, like the baby, the newborn, and it is the older people that have lost their immune system, and it is sort of like the others that might have acquired immune deficiency, such as HIV. They have frequently actually avian tuberculosis, and they are treated for that for many months and years and so on.
So is it a contagious disease just to humans, or could it be a contagious disease to a young puppy and an older dog?
It is really, I don't want to call it is a highly contagious disease, but you need to keep in mind in these dogs, when they are sick, they have excretions such as urine, feces, a nasal discharge, coughing, all of that urine that is loaded with these bacteria. It is really heavy, heavy loaded. And so in contrast to what we get exposed on a normal basis, there's obviously a huge exposure. And, you know, a baby crawling on the floor is going to be more likely exposed than an adult. Another puppy could get exposed too, but dogs as well as people in general are resistant. And so they're not going to get it unless they have the genetic predisposition or are overwhelmed or have another kinds of, you know, kind of disease where they can get it. So I would just be very, taking precaution. So I think if you have a dog that has such clinical signs, it would be best to really get to the definitive diagnosis. And we think at the moment it is avian tuberculosis, but we are talking about other infectious agents too that might be in the same group or something. But we don't know that yet.
And then a carrier, could a carrier at some point in their lives have an exasperation through having a weakness within the immune system? Could they then have a breakout of this?
We do not think that's going to be the case, because in the grand scheme of genetics, from the classic side, when it is a recessive disease, an autosomal recessive disease, we are talking about that one carrier has one normal gene and one mutant bad gene, right? But what nature has done in general, with some exceptions, it is that one gene is sufficient to get good function, you know? And so if you have one good gene, that gives you 50%, not 100%, because the other gene is not functional. But 50% works sufficiently to get you a good immune system.
So it can suppress the bad.
No, it doesn't. The bad one is just not functional. So Instead of having 100% because of two genes, you have 50%. And we can show that, not for this disease, that's what we need to do, but we can show that for other diseases, like mucopolysaccharidosis, or we can show for myotonia. They're functioning perfectly normal. Now, if you look at the dog which is a carrier for myotonia, you might actually be thinking the dog might have a little more muscle. And that's probably why the dog was fairly popular, Shooting Sparks, you know, because he had a better musculature. And that might show through. For the immune deficiency, I would not expect that. We have not seen it. We have not heard of that. So I would be very happy with a carrier. Is there a benefit to be a carrier? I doubt. You know, this just happened in this particular case. So there's not a known benefit to be a carrier. But I would think there's really no risk in regard to that.
I do have one question. I don't know if you can answer it, Doctor, but now that we put MAC on chick, how do we tie it in with the test?
with the test?
Uh-huh.
Well, the way it goes is because we are keeping confidentiality and we are not going to disclose anywhere. It's your obligation
right.
to send that test in, and it's going to be loaded up.
Okay.
I mean, I'm in good contact.
There's no way to, I'm sitting here on my phone. There's no way to tie it in.
I don't know if you can just send an email by that, but I actually never load up any of the results to check myself, so I think you need to see how did you load up any of your physical exams.
It's like you send your result in to
okay.
check.
There was
it's
no
like,
instructions.
Just like you would your, you know, your SERP exam
yeah,
and things like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think it's exactly the same, and they accept that.
Now the problem with CHIMP, and it's widely known because there are other diseases that are similarly affected, is that they don't have a good way to identify clearance by parentage. And the reason they don't is because that's when our little Norwegian fellow back there, they need to be assured that the parentage is correct. So in order to get clearance by parentage, you would have to prove the parentage of the dog that you were putting in as clear by parentage, which would be a substantial cost, really.
More than the test.
Right, more than the test. So it's just easier to just go in and say, you know, just test them all. And, it, you know, if you're using them for breeding, I think it's obviously.
Thanks.
Any other questions? My goodness, I can't believe
it.
Okay.
Are we going to get this?
I have asked Dr. Giger to provide us with the slides, and he has graciously agreed to do that.
Thank you.
And I am, and I warned him ahead of time, but I didn't warn y'all. I don't know if this is going to come back and get me. But we have been taping this. I'm that kind of person. But anyway, I hope to get it transcribed, and that will become a companion document for his slides as well.
Excellent.
Well,
yeah, use it for your own good. You know, this is not all published, and so you understand that that's not to be, you know, publicized, I mean, within your group, that's perfectly fine, meaning in the
right.
house, but not
yeah.
everywhere
so don't
else.
Put it on Facebook.
Right, yeah. Please don't put it on Facebook. Anyway, thank you, Dr. Giger. And also a big hand for
Pedro.
Pedro. I think there may be some more food back there.
There's food. We're going to have the bartender come back in, so she'll be serving beverages.
You're welcome
and
to stay.
Then
we will have that. But you're welcome.
A little longer before we start my
yeah.
presentation.
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. I was surprised there weren't much money.
Yes.
I mean, but you were just mesmerized. And I know certainly that the talk with the Danish people, that is a huge help.
I know they have breakfast.
Because I'm getting emails and other people that are getting ready to send more samples. So that's going to be really good. And this lady right here, here, you have to stand up. Wait a minute. Oh, yeah. I'll see. I'm not good with
names. You're going to be your last time.
Right. And she is our contact in South America.
And I have to explain to you the, that now I think I need to know this, it's not that it's a slap of money.
Right, but if it is a line of money,
because, you know, when you think that we're here, how much do you sell your products?
Well, we sell them for, probably.
And we sell them for people. So it's so, you know, everybody, when I brought this one, and everybody was, and then we said, okay, dogs must be checked, and test is certified. And so when you add all to get this already, And that is true because we have been importing and tinkering, grinding in particular.
And you know, I think we should work on this together. I don't want to say the name right now, but you know them.
I know exactly.
That might be, we say, okay, you get me 50 samples and we will do them. So, I think we want to get the. Our goal is really to test rather than
thank you, I appreciate
it. I kind of guess that in advance, but it's so beautiful for us to come and say.
You're from Norway?
Yes.
Okay, that's a different story. They're rich. They hold the oil. It's an expensive country.
Yeah. Okay, so let me give you, this is Hilda Hankinson. Yeah.
We were here for your life, and I think it's very positive to hear from you this time around, because we were part of that whole Mitonia go around, and the rumors were, you know, they're mixing up the samples, we're getting wrong results. So the whole thing was like, you know, you put in all this effort, you collect all these samples, and then just nothing comes out. So it's so good to come here and see that this actually had a broad conclusion. Because that re-engages you, and then you.
But I think the main thing too.
Yeah, and the Mitonia should have been fine too.
Yeah.
But you know, technologies have even a little bit more improvement. You can't get any more better on the technical side. It's really a human error from sample identification. So, and you know, Scandinavia does have a bigger process.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
It's known.
I think there's like three cases.
The main thing, and thank you, and what we ran into when we had such a furor when we started with the Lola case was people were just willy-nilly taking dogs and spaying them and taking
Another thing I really want to... I mean, it was really, really good to find out that if you have an infected, please don't just get rid of it. Because that's what makes you panic, and then you lose so many good dogs. Because people don't know what to do, they just don't want to touch it. You're going to be systematic, just a way out of it, and you can kill the good dogs. So I'm very glad that you have been
And I think the and we did actually force that in numerous other diseases. We always stress the point, don't eliminate
And even for breeders, just to say, oh, I quit breeding is actually not a good thing, because that means that group of...
That line is
yes,
gone.
Exactly. And I'm with Carol, we never saw
I have the greatest admiration for her.
Oh, well, she raised money. She did everything. She felt so bad, did it on purpose. And here we are today. It's fantastic. Really happy.
So hopefully you can carry it back home to Scandinavia.
I hopefully, I actually live here.
Oh, you live here?
My friend is here. You know, it's a different town. Everything is very regulated, very controlled, and they're like, very more, like we said,
it's regulated.
They're cutting off their
hands. It's too much.
I want to mention something else. Hilda has been a great source to me because she's done a lot of translation of the documents. So remember me sending you these things and saying, please get somebody to translate it into this foreign language. And she's been very helpful doing it. So it's a good job.
You know, I've been on, there's been different forms that have never resulted in anything.
Yeah,
the different pattern.
Right.
We've been connected. And there is never a confusion. So you just look stupid because you're out there campaigning, you know, sending your, you're out collecting things, sending it in. And there's nothing that you're sending it in. So,
I mean, we have several tests now, just for the genetics, and I didn't talk about others, you know, I mean, the myotonia, the muscular, the metabolic acidosis, and then this, and then the oxalate, and the hypolipidemia, you know, it's booming.
I think now that you have the tools and technology.
Yeah. No,
it's very exciting.
So yeah. It's an exciting part, but then if you just translate what was written by Patty and me,
that's a great idea.
You know,
so we can spread the word.
Right, and it's, you might actually check with the Danish, because they may have done it already.
Yeah.
Danish is similar to Norwegian. Swedish.
Yeah, we can do that.
So, and I assume you don't do fish.
No, but I have Finnish friends.
Because that's a very different language.
Now, Dr. Giger spoke to the Danish. They had breeders from around the area. From Norway was there in Sweden. Some Germans, I'm not quite sure. Total bunch. But we were able to Skype in and talk to them. And he was so, and they were excited. Very excited. We started getting. There was nothing.
And I think I will be happy to
do this.
It's such a nebulous thing. This researcher out there is doing all this research. To hear him talk and to answer questions was outstanding. Carry on.
So what brought you to the U.S.?
Oh, I've been here since 2000. I live in Atlanta.
So they're living in the
family.
How did you get to the
U.S.? Well, you know,
Well, anyone who can afford has
it's exciting because, you know, to me, you're a neighbor, and I associate
Okay, thank you.
So did you show?
Yes, I've shown. But she did the yesterday.
It's always interesting to think if you bring in a foreign dog, how it would do.
Well, I do that because I cooperate with breeders all over the world, actually. So what I do is give them my best copy, and a few years later I will get them there, but actually cooperate. My lines are a combination of my old Norwegian, the European lines, and the American lines. And I have a situation, but I'm not a scientist. I don't want any secret dogs. I think genetics, you know, that we have a wide genome, I think it's important. If you read some of these genetics, they say there is no such thing as inbreeding. All you do is establish it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do that. It's a shortcut to the story that literally
Okay, everybody, come on in. We're gonna have our family.
I want to just demount here quickly that you can have your business meeting.
Okay.
You want to quickly help her?
Just wanted to thank you so much for your
kindness.
And we're going to get in touch.
Yeah, I mean, maybe give me even a proposal that you think will be doable. So.
Yes. Thank you.
I want to welcome you to the 2016 Montgomery County meeting. And again, we want to thank Dr. Deeger for a wonderful presentation and for just answering a lot of questions for us. So.